They've come to be known as monster houses. They're large dwellings that go up on large lots, sometimes with more than 20 bedrooms and nearly as many bathrooms. If that doesn't sound like a single-family home to you, you're not alone. And that's worrying a lot of residents. Honolulu City Council is considering measures to manage this trend, and Councilwoman Ann Kobayashi is one of several who have introduced bills to address this. She talked with my colleague News Director Bill Dorman about her bill and her concerns.
Before we get into the specific legislation that you've introduced, let me start just by asking when this became an issue of attention for the City Council and what brought it to that level.
Well, you know, years ago, around the university, when someone tried to build a house with, say, 8 bedrooms, mm-hmm. the department would question that and say, you're a single-family home, how can you have 8 bedrooms? And, you know, their permit would be denied. And now, all of a sudden, you can have 20 bedrooms, and people are getting permits for them. I just don't understand.
And so why is this an issue for City Council, as opposed to, sort of as you suggest, the City Department of Planning and Permitting?
Mm-hmm. Because if these affect our neighborhoods, not only, you know, the huge house right next to you or in front of you, but it affects the parking. We wonder about the sewer system. And so that's why we're questioning all of this. And the problem, too, is that it's occurring more frequently.
And do you have any kind of, I don't know, working assumption about how these buildings are going to be used?
Well, if they're in apartment zones, that's fine. But we worry that, you know, there might be used for short-term rentals, which certainly doesn't help our problem of providing more affordable rentals for our own residents. And some say, well, it's going to be a nursing home. Well, to do that, you have to be licensed. And you can't have more than 5 unrelated people in a home. So in a residential area, anyway, even if they rent out their bedrooms long-term, you can't have more than 5 people. So why they would need 20 bedrooms, that's why people question this. And can you imagine 20 more cars on the road in a small residential area?
Capacity clearly is one of the issues that you're dealing with. But we are clearly in a housing crisis in Honolulu. So just to play devil's advocate for a moment, if someone uses a big house to rent relatively cheaper units to tenants, isn't that something that would help with affordable housing?
That would be wonderful. And that's what used to happen around the University of Hawaii. They would rent out to students. But now people are finding that renting short-term to tourists, they get a lot more money. And so this is of great concern, because then we're not helping our residents and the housing shortage.
So the idea in terms of where this goes, I know you mentioned you were just at a neighborhood board meeting in Hilolo. What was the word on the street there?
Well, they're worried because a lot of the big houses are in strictly residential areas, and they see all these cars coming, and it's hard. You know, we added 6 more inspectors to the department to look into these, if they are illegal, because permits have not been given out for bed and breakfast since 1989 because of the effect on neighborhoods. And so the council did send 4 measures to the Planning Commission, and the mayor will be appointing a task force to see how we deal with this issue. But these monster homes are, you know, right next to you, or on Willamina Rise, someone built one right in front of this woman and lost her whole view.
Now, you've introduced a bill that would create a new tax category for these houses, as you mentioned, in terms of finding out what else is going on. But this new tax category, why is that something that you see as necessary?
Well, because the neighbors around this house, you know, the assessments go up. When this huge house goes up, then the assessment goes up, and the neighbors were worried that their property tax would then also go up. So So that's why I introduced the bill to tax the larger homes more. Then maybe in that neighborhood they won't have to raise the assessment on the neighbors. But we'll have to see how that goes through the budget committee.
You know, just in terms of anecdotally, as you hear stories about these houses going up, there always seems to be almost an air of mystery attached to these.
Yeah.
Of, you know, where did these come from? Who wants to, I mean, are you finding that, because the council is starting to look into this a bit more deeply, or are you finding that to be the case?
Yeah, it does, because it used to be a family, you know, and then, you know, they're maybe having a multi-generational house, which has happened. You know, grandma lives there, their children, and then their grandchildren, and that's great because it does provide housing and everyone's together. But I don't know, in some cases, the houses are sold to someone who's not known in the neighborhood, and then the neighbors worry, who else is coming into our neighborhood?
But the idea, again, in terms of back to volume, and a lot of times this comes down to analyzing numbers of bedrooms, numbers of bathrooms.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of, I realize there's legislation on the table also about putting a moratorium on these. But in terms of what comes next, it sounds like still at a fact-finding stage.
Well, we have been dealing with this on and off, these big houses that go up, and what is the purpose, and then sometimes it is for a nursing home, and so they're restricted to the 5 people. But, you know, this is getting out of hand, because I think it's in Halava somewhere. They have 29 bedrooms and 17 bathrooms. You know, that there is certainly an air of mystery about that. And just think of the effect on the sewer system and all those cars. So Councilmember Ozawa also introduced a measure to that if you have over a certain number of bedrooms, you have to have an equal number of off-street parking.
Mm. Well, when you step back and take a look at the overall picture, what do you think the most important point for Honolulu residents to bear in mind is as they watch the developments with these so-called monster houses?
Right. Well, see, if you're in a strictly residential area, then you want to protect your neighborhood and not have these monster homes go up and who's living next door to you and all the parking out on the street. So that's the main concern, I think, in residential areas.
All right. Well, Councilwoman, thanks so much for making time for us today on the conversation.
Sure. Thank you.
Ann Kobayashi represents District 5 on the Honolulu City Council, covering an area that includes Kaimuki, Palolo Valley, St. Louis Heights, Manoa, Mo'ili'ili, McCully, and parts of Alamoana, Kaka'ako, and Makiki.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the Pakistani-American relationship from Pakistan's perspective. But first, your quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a country singing superstar who spent much of the 80s traveling around the Hawaiian Islands, leaving traces of her presence behind. She produced an episode of her show on Oahu and even opened a quick-to-fail restaurant in Hawaii Kai called Dockside Plantation. The restaurant's name contains a hidden clue to the singer's name, and the menu toted dishes that played the celebrity angle up, including DP's seafood favorite. Unfortunately, People magazine didn't have rave reviews for that particular dish. The food critic wrote it had 4 kinds of vegetables, perfectly cooked, and 4 kinds of fish so overcooked I couldn't tell the opaka-paka from the scallops. This country darling opened a restaurant on Halloween night in 1987. She was there along with a number of people dressed like her for the opening costume party. For months, it was hard to get a reservation as starstruck Honolulu residents rushed to eat there. Everyone soon realized the food was questionable, and the singer hired Gordon Hopkins, now of Roy's Restaurant fame, to try to salvage Dockside Plantation. It shuttered its doors in less than a year, but the Grammy Award winner still traveled back to Oahu Open, and today we're looking for that singer's name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha mai kākou. This is Ku'uipo Kumukahi, Manager of Hawaiian Culture and Community Relations at the Hyatt Regency Waikiki, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
President Trump is wrapping up a nearly two-week trip to the Asia-Pacific, or as he has been referring to it recently, the Indo-Pacific. That grouping includes India, but not the other part of the subcontinent, Pakistan. Pakistan's Consul General, Abdul Jabbar Memon, is in town this week in Honolulu, giving public remarks at 3 o'clock this afternoon at the East-West Center. Earlier this morning, he spoke with my colleague, Bill Dorman.
Overall, in terms of the new administration, and really since the end of the Obama administration, there has been a lot of attention with India, visits and exchanges and talk about the relationship with India, perhaps less so with Pakistan. How are relations with the United States from your perspective?
Let me be very frank and honest that relationship with America for us is of paramount importance. For us, America is the first and foremost country with which we would like to build the best bilateral relations. And historically speaking, we have been partners with America in all initiatives since 1947 when we came into being. In international relations, you cannot say that there would be always a static and the best relations ever between the two countries. There are always ups and downs. So we have the history of fluctuating trajectory between the bilateral relations Pakistan and United States. But at the end, we always look after each other, and we always serve as good friends and partners in all domains of the bilateral relations. So India, as you said, I believe that has been a little problem in our bilateral relations, especially during the after induction of the Trump government. There are certain issues, as you know very well, that this Afghanistan, the problem in Afghanistan and war against terrorism, there are certain misperceptions or certain kind of doubts have been created in the mind of Trump administration that probably Pakistan is not in a way serving Pakistan is not becoming this part of the solution rather than becoming the problem.
And tell me about some of those misperceptions. What do you feel is being misperceived?
You know,
Pakistan?
That main concern for Trump administration is that that's probably Pakistan is in a way harboring or providing sanctuaries to some networks. Normally they blame that Haqqani Network and few other organizations are being. And the operation which is going on in Pakistan is not across the board, and it's targeted. And so for me, it looks incredible that when we are conducting operation, as you know, that Operation Zarb-e Azab and then Operation Radal Fasad, it's being conducted transparently across the board against all terrorist elements, against all militants in Pakistan. we cannot exclude or include. Those results have been achieved. If you are familiar, what we had problems in Pakistan, say, a few years before, now we have almost eliminated terrorism within our country, and we are still fighting. So blaming or accusing that we are supporting one group and in a way to harm the interest of Americans or Afghanistan or any other country in the neighborhood. For us, peaceful neighborhood is our policy, and we would like to be to maintain peaceful relations with India as well as see peace and prosperity in Afghanistan. Because if anything bad happens in Afghanistan, we are sharing 2,600 kilometers border with Afghanistan. It's spillover effect. We cannot save ourselves from its spillover effects. And then logically speaking, that okay, if you people think that in a way Pakistan is supporting to Haqqani network, then these 70,000 dead bodies, including 15,000 of our military people who have been killed in this all 15-16 years, all those have been killed and this massacre has been done by Haqqani network. Or this was Pakistan's state-sponsored operation against its own people. It looks absurd. I think it's mere accusations. We have given sacrifices, and we have suffered more than any country in the world has suffered in war against terrorism.
Part of, I think, if I may, on the skepticism about the cooperation when it comes to terror. The Pakistani intelligence ISI, let me ask it this way, how are cooperations at this point between Pakistani intelligence, the ISI, and the United States intelligence networks when it comes to combating terrorism?
I think there shouldn't be any doubt in anyone's minds that Pakistan's intelligence agency is any kind of skepticism or any kinds of suspicion is being created against ISI. That's the agency which has been working very hard since 1979 when you saw with your own eyes that Russia was invaded in Afghanistan, and then post 9/11, this agency is working in collaboration with all other agencies who wants to eliminate terrorism from that region.
Although also within history, it is true that the United States intelligence agencies funneled the aid to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan by way of ISI, and some of that money wound up in not the best places for America's purposes.
It's now an open secret. I need not to. It doesn't look nice to mention these things on a public forum, but those Mujahideen, these 80,000 Mujahideen who fought in Afghanistan, and became one of the major reason of disintegration of Russia and then withdrawal of Russians from Afghanistan. But later on, if you abandon them and leave them unattended, and then they become, God forbid, in a way, pain in your neck, then it relates to our mismanagement and our policy-related issues. So I believe that this is also something which is being widely publicized in the world, that probably ISI is doing some kind of nuisance in this region, or it's not acceptable. That works under the government of Pakistan, and there's the established command and control system, and they all work in line with our national interest, and no doubt in war against terrorism, we are fully supporting all partner countries, including United States of America. And we have been, world has seen that since 9/11, Pakistan has been extending all possible support to all stakeholders in eliminating this menace, because we are ourselves suffering from this menace badly.
And so at this point, in terms of the United States and Americans who may not have Pakistan in their consciousness as much, what do you think Americans need to know and understand about Pakistan that they do not?
I think the main problem with the Americans is that they probably they are thinking that if any kind of failure in Afghanistan or in this war against terrorism, they shift unilateral responsibility on Pakistan. That's the great injustice. I think we should share success and failures together. Pakistan, I think, is the major partner and major supporter, and this issue relates to the perceptions and image. I don't know why this kind of image and perception has been projected among Americans as well, that this is the Pakistan which has the main, which is the main problem, and that's the reason why American forces or NATO forces are not getting victory in Afghanistan. So but through this you can gain some kind of soft corner or sympathy among Americans. But we need to understand that we all have. We supported when you used your military powers. We supported Americans when you asked about the reconciliation and negotiation process. I again here reiterate that Afghan solution is not only lies in the military use of military or the military power. It has to be the blend of both, or more emphasis on the negotiation and reconciliation track. What you will do if you have not been able to, there are two tracks only. One is the military track and the other is the reconciliation and peace track. You have utilized your military in last 16 years, not only the United States, but all NATO powers collectively. They have not been able to gain that success which they were aspiring for. Now, what's the another track? Another track is the reconciliation and political negotiation and political track. I think Americans are not concentrating against this Trump policy, which has been released in August, that again is talking about the military might. They are not talking about the reconciliation and negotiation process.
And so, part of helping with that diplomatic process, Abdul Jabbar Mehman, Consul General of Pakistan in Los Angeles, here in Honolulu and at the East-West Center this afternoon, 3 o'clock, John Burns Hall, for a lecture on an update on relations between Pakistan and the United States and remarks on opportunities for cooperation between the two countries. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you much. I'm so grateful for providing me an opportunity to be here and sharing my views with you.
HPR's Atherton Studio is the place to find so many of Hawaii's musical stars. On Saturday the 18th, it's vocalist Star Kalahiki with her longtime collaborator, pianist Kit Ebersbach. They'll delight you with lounge standards, show tunes, and Hawaiian classics. Your tickets are at 955-8821 during business hours or hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
There are any number of good reasons to recycle, and the city has any number of good reasons to promote recycling, but cost effectiveness is not one of them. The cost of processing a ton of paper, aluminum, plastic, glass, and other recyclables through the curbside blue bin program has tripled in less than a decade. Should some of those recyclables be burned instead, as an audit of the program recommends? Civil Beat reporting fellow Natanya Friedheim has more in today's Reality Check. Good morning, Natanya.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. There's an uncomfortable reality at the heart of your story, which is that recycling actually costs quite a bit of money, doesn't it?
It does, and as the cost to process the material increases, the value of the material on the global market is decreasing, mm-hmm. Which, you know, we used to be able to make some money off of the material, and it's getting tougher as the years go by, which isn't to say that the price might go back up. It's the market fluctuates, but right now it's definitely in a slump.
And right now it's probably costing, would you say, a disproportionate amount to recycle compared to the good that is, you know, the benefits of recycling?
Well, it depends whether you're talking about environmental benefits, which are obviously a little more difficult to calculate, versus financial benefits. Definitely in terms of finances, it costs a lot of money compared to what the city is getting back for the recyclable material.
And what was the recommendation? This program got audited. What was the recommendation made?
The audit recommended that the city send the recyclables that it collects in the blue bins to H-Power, which is the waste-to-energy incinerator mm-hmm. that Honolulu has. And part of the reason why that would help the city is because the city is required to deliver 800,000 tons of trash to the incinerator every year, and Honolulu isn't producing enough trash to meet that requirement.
Mm-hmm.
And because we fall short of that requirement, the city actually needs to pay Covanta, which is the company that operates H-Power.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know, because we're not making money off of these recyclables and it's costing a lot to process them and ship them off, the audit said, well, hey, why don't you just bring the material to the incinerator and burn it? The trouble with that is glass and aluminum don't burn, so we would probably still have to sort the material in the blue bins.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard because the amount that we collect in the blue bins actually still wouldn't make up that 800,000 tonnage, but it would help a little bit.
Well, what are the alternatives to doing that? What are some of the other alternatives being proposed? Just stick with what we're doing?
Stick with what we're doing, and some people are recommending that, you know, we continue to collect these recyclables, but we start industries on island that would process the recyclable material. People have talked about crushing glass to create glassfalt, which is like asphalt with glass in it, mm-hmm. for roadways. There are some issues with that. I think state regulations might not allow glassfalt, but that has to be investigated a little further. People have recommended putting cardboard, mixing it in with green waste to produce soil, because that breaks down in composting mm-hmm. Facilities. And ultimately, consuming less, you know, buying less material would obviously help, you know, for the environment. We wouldn't be producing as much trash, and we wouldn't have to process all of these recyclables. So, for example, Stuart Coleman of the Surfrider Foundation recommended introducing programs where we would reuse bottles. So, you know, in the old day, before my time, to get milk, you would, you know, drink the milk in the glass bottle and then return the bottles to the milkman. So why not reintroduce programs like that, where rather than throwing away after single use, you know, give it back to the company that creates the product?
Well, that's a, you know, that's a memory some of us have, but we've become a really disposable society, Natanya. So we'll want to keep track of where this story goes. Thanks very much for
Definitely.
Talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporting fellow Natanya Friedheim. Is high-end chocolate a key to Hawaii's agricultural future? Beans from a University of Hawaii cacao trial begun in 2005 have now been judged among the best in the world. They were among the 18 International Cocoa Awards winners announced at the Salon du Chocolat in Paris earlier this month. UH College of Tropical Agriculture Extension Specialist Skip Bittenbender spoke with us about Hawaii's newly found prestige among the world's chocolatiers.
Well, we wanted to develop varieties for the state.
Right.
And so we had to test a bunch of seedlings. We would do all the fermentation in my lab, and we would do the roasting and making the chocolate in my lab. We had a cooperator on the mainland who we could send him roasted nibs, and uh-huh. he could convert that into cocoa liquor, and we began tasting that as a way to determine it.
Uh-huh.
We finally decided that at least one of the selections was worth releasing to the public. In the meantime, as we're doing all these harvests, one particular day I had much more cacao than I could handle in my small fermentary,
uh-huh.
and my student Dan, who had since left the university, took the seed from these three varieties and three locations and fermented them at his location, and then later on submitted them to the Cocoa of Excellence competition.
Uh-huh.
And so these are the varieties that I just mentioned, 3, 4, and 5, from those three locations,
Kualoa right.
and Waimanalo and Pearl City.
So this is locally originated?
Yes. Yes. The all the material was essentially born here
uh-huh.
because we have inherited this good collection of genetic material.
from those who went before couple of decades earlier, bringing cacao to Hawaii in the first place.
Right. Yeah, first got here in about 1841, I think.
Uh-huh. But it really looks as if there's a kind of a robust future for cacao as a kind of luxury crop, high revenue, low land use crop, right?
Yes, I think so. It's something that can be grown on a small farm, an acre or two, or something that can be grown larger. And we're starting to see expansion now. So we're going to see some larger growers, and we're going to see the smaller gentleman farm type growers. But all the cacao is still of value. It doesn't matter if it's a small, as long as it's fermented well and dried properly, it's got a lot of potential.
And that's a process you were describing to me earlier that's an extremely elaborate. Sounds pretty labor-intensive, too.
It is, and this is this can go for us or against us because labor is always hard to come by, and cacao has to be harvested by hand because the pods are strongly attached to the tree. But we're looking at other areas where we can reduce labor, such as in the cracking of the pods and whatnot.
One thing that struck me about it, you brought in a wonderful tasting sample, and it seemed to have a, you know, what you would describe as a really complex flavor, and yet it has essentially, what, two ingredients?
Right. Yeah, normally I make a single tree chocolate, but this time I tried to reproduce the chocolate that got the award. So I actually have three different trees in here and the effect of three different locations.
And it varies that much from the strain of the tree and from location?
Well, it does vary, but I think Hawaii is going to be known for a fruity, raisiny chocolate.
Uh-huh.
This seems to be our signature notes. It may be genetic, but I suspect it may be a yeast that is prevalent in the islands because we're starting to understand more about chocolate flavor and how it is modified by the location.
A yeast that originates in the soil itself?
Well, it would be here in the environment. Yes, when we make our ferments, what I do is I open up the pod, remove the seeds, and roll the surface of the pod, the outside, the rind, across the seeds to transfer the microorganisms that are on the pod into the seeds. And this way we try to capture what I call the terroir of a location, because the terroir is not just the soil, it's what's living in that area as well as the climate and rainfall and management.
This is what makes different types of wine taste different.
Right.
Same kind of. Isn't that a wine term, terroir?
It is. Yes.
So, at some point, it's almost a random factor, right? As you say, a collection of microorganisms. Mm-hmm. You don't know exactly which microorganisms.
No, we're doing the work now to find out what they are, and it's completely possible to develop a inoculum, just like the wine growers use and the beer makers use. They use they kill off all the other microorganisms and use the ones that they want. And we may go to that at some point, but we might not as well.
All the processes that you described to get to this the cacao bean that you've got today are essentially the action of nature on itself, right?
Yes. This is a very natural process.
As you said, you described a process similar to composting, where just by packing materials together, they generate heat. They generate the heat you need for the fermentation.
Right. It's the microorganisms that are growing in the compost. It's their energy that is making the heat. Well, they're taking the chemicals out of what is being composted, but the microorganisms, they make it get hot. Yeah, it's
you know what's fascinating about science today, as advanced as it is that a lot of times it comes down to invisible bugs.
Yes. I mean, everything that we're doing in agriculture today still goes back to the basic components of life.
Skip Bittenbender is a specialist and a professor in the Tropical Plant and Soil Sciences Department of the College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resources at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. His cacao work started in earnest in 2005 and was done with his graduate students Dan O'Doherty, Jason Myers, and Eric Kling.
Aloha, I'm Kupa'a from Kailua, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our small planet, and also what we can look for in our dark island skies. As usual, turning to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. He's on the line right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. For this week's stargazers, look out for Venus in the morning sky, easily visible in the east during sunrise. The moon this week is a mere crescent, providing us with nice dark skies as it passes through its new moon phase.
This week, we have exciting news coming to us from South America, I understand. A discovery that relates to one of our nearest neighbors?
It does indeed. Now, normally here on Stargazer, when we talk about planets around other stars, we normally talk about stars that are very, very far away. But this small red dwarf star known as Proxima Centauri is our closest neighbor, and it has been found to be surrounded by perhaps several belts of dust and debris, indicating that our nearest neighbor may in fact be host to an elaborate planetary system.
So in our solar system, these sorts of belts of debris that you're describing are usually left over from the formation of planets. So I'm guessing this is pretty compelling evidence.
It sure is. It could mean that there have been fully formed planets in orbit around Proxima Centauri, perhaps for billions of years.
And considering its proximity to us, how come we haven't looked at this before?
Well, for a long time, the capability to study even the nearest stars in great detail just didn't exist. This latest discovery was the result of using ALMA, the submillimeter array in Chile. Only with its high-resolution instruments were we able to detect this.
Is this the kind of thing the 30-meter telescope, if and when it's ever built somewhere, will be able to have a real good look at, or no, not the right kind of telescope?
Yeah, it absolutely will be able to look at this, but it will probably have to look at it in something like infrared instead of visible light.
So the place in South America is using radio waves, not optical or infrared.
Exactly.
Ah, and I'm also guessing that dwarf stars are thought to be quite hostile, too, as far as hostility among celestial objects goes.
They are indeed. Dwarf stars are known for their tantrums and periods of violent outbursts that could potentially disrupt planets, as well as the atmospheres of planets that are lucky enough to form.
Bad temperament, those little buggers, huh?
Absolutely.
It's Christopher Phillips and another fun and enlightening Stargazer report. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We will catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, designer of the Culinary Institute of the Pacific, committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design, providing research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
This country singer is known for ghostwriting hits for other stars, including the chart-topping I Will Always Love You, made popular by Whitney Houston. In her own career, she has 25 songs, reaching number one on the Billboard Country Music Charts, a record for a female artist. She also has won 9 Grammy Awards, 2 Academy Award nominations, 10 Country Music Association Awards, 7 Academy of Country Music Awards, 3 American Music Awards, and is one of only 7 female artists to win the Country Music Association's Entertainer of the Year Award. This celebrity traveled extensively throughout the Hawaiian Islands and opened the episode of her show singing in front of Waimea Falls on Oahu. In her theme park on the mainland, she contracted Skyline Echo Adventures of Maui to build the first multi-line zip line tour inside a theme park. In addition to her singing career, she's appeared and starred in several Hollywood productions. You might know her as Truvy Jones in Steel Magnolia, or even seen Dolly Parton appearing as herself in Hannah Montana, the show that propelled her goddaughter Miley Cyrus into stardom. Several people got that right, but Roger Komori of Wahiawa was the first. He's our backyard quiz winner, and that's today's quiz. If you've got one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. It's not easy to make art when your head is scrambled by the troubles of a troubled world, and the information revolution makes these troubles impossible to escape. Mel Chin is an artist who's visiting the University of Hawaii as the Dai Ho Chun Distinguished Chair. He's giving a talk later this week called Trouble in Mind, about the place of the artist in a troubled world, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning, Mel.
Hey, Chris, how you doing? Aloha, I should say.
Yes, you should.
Yeah, man, get it straight.
Well, thanks for coming.
All right, it's good to be here.
The traditional view of the artist's frame of mind is, you know, the garret studio, detached from the turmoil beneath, right?
Right.
Living only for the interaction of paints on canvas or the shapes he's creating in a sculpture. You know what I'm saying?
I know exactly.
How do you do that in a world where you can't take three steps without finding out your phone alerting you to some disaster?
Well, it's ironic because I live in that garret-like surroundings in the hills of North Carolina and Appalachia.
Uh-huh.
However, my practice is definitely not just that. And it's almost like, because you don't escape being an artist, but maybe escape the definitions as applied.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of like to say I'm always in a state of becoming as opposed to being an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And that frees me for my main passion and my main direction is conceptual. It's a thought first.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm troubled by needing reality therapy. And I like to manifest these ideas into concrete actions,
mm-hmm,
or works, whether if it needs to be that paint, it will be that. But if it needs to be that film, it'll be that. If it needs to be an international action or a national action of combining whole groups of people, it will be that.
This is the contemporary expanded view of what an artwork is. An artwork can be an action.
Absolutely. You know, just speaking of trouble, you know, everybody, because of mass communications, and you can't escape that, even though it's waning, mm-hmm, is a concern for a place called Flint, Michigan.
Yeah.
You know, and Flint, obviously an egregious kind of situation happened there, a crisis of lead poisoning.
Mm-hmm. So tainted water.
Yes.
What's more fundamental than that?
Yeah, really. So for 10 years, I've been working on this project called the Funded Project, which was started in New Orleans, but basically it's about lead poisoning of children, and it's a pro bono kind of thing where we have like a half a million drawings of people drawing their own $100 bill,
mm-hmm,
and it's more of a case where to show the value of an individual who really can't vote, who may be eight, who's being poisoned, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's in D.C. now as the Funded Reserve, so naturally I would go to Flint and try to give that project, mm-hmm, a start. But when I was there, you know, being an artist also is being responsive and interactive with what's going down.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to someone, what you doing with all those bottles? You know? And I said, well, don't know. I said, well, do you mind if I just take those? Will you ship it? So we started a project I'm very excited about called Flint Fit. As you mentioned, fashion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this is to take all the bottles that they'll lend us for this prototype and shipping it down to North Carolina, where they're going to transform it into thread and fabric. And then I went up to Tracy Reese, who designed Michelle Obama's 2012 convention dress,
mm-hmm,
fashion designer in New York. And I said, Tracy, do you mind designing rainwear, swimwear out of this fabric?
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back to Flint, which I knew had a sewing concern of women working at the New Life Women's Center for women who have luckily escaped domestic violence and different things,
mm-hmm,
that are sewing commercial goods. And from there, that project will be born. And so that happened outside the garret of
very much outside the
yeah,
garret.
Yeah, but I'm so excited about it because it started. We're going to get the first big shipment of bottles down to the Unified Corporation, and we're going to start this project. And it's a prototype. It's almost like, okay, we know the water's bad, lead's bad, and things are difficult. But from a creative point of view, what other options could I possibly survive?
Well, you you have a situation that you looked at, and you looked at it as an artist. You know, how do I react to this? Do I write an editorial for the newspaper? Who cares, right?
Yeah.
The only people who are going to read that are the people who already probably agree with you anyway.
Yeah.
So how do you make people feel what it's like to be an 8-year-old kid growing up drinking tainted water, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
That's where the artist comes in, yeah?
Yeah, well, sometimes also it's like, how do you reanimate just something like when you're faced with hopelessness? Okay, so the water's bad, manufacturing's gone, everything's negative,
yeah.
The muse never can get better. And so you say, well, maybe that's what I have to look forward to, you know, to create, help create. And then I say help because nothing happens in these public works without people giving their approval. I think it's not something that you can actually, you cannot parachute helicopter in and do these things, and it's a slow process of agreements, and so the art, the work itself, the object of art has changed for me. There still will be an object, but it may be a prototype for an industry that will exist beyond me, you know.
It seems to me that what you're describing, Mel, is the artist as a link between you know, politics and emotion. This is the impact of a political situation, of a sociological, whatever.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's always, is that political? Is that art? But, you know, you can't escape politics and thinking and the relationship. And I think we live in an age where we're so polarized, and those polarizations, based on your preface, are based on belief, you know, and they're not facts, and they can bypass facts.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am truly interested in not saying that I have better facts or better point of view from left or right or wherever side you want to go from. But I said, you know, what's missing sometimes is the option for movement. Sometimes you have to create the catalytic structure for new language and new places to be formed.
Mm-hmm.
And I truly believe that is a purpose that I found that incorporates the poetics of an idea with the pragmatism of action, you see.
It seems to me that coming from that very external place of the artist, as you describe yourself, parachuting in. But there's some benefits to that because you're not invested in prior ways of doing things.
That's right. There should be, there's very, very little investment in the way things have come before. In my own world of working, you know, like I say, if it needs to be a oil painting and it needs to have this special aura that art can supply, the term art in quotations, of course, then I will invest a lot in that and make it the best possible looking thing to have the formal qualities to actually lure you into what it really is about, you know. And when I say you, I mean myself, because the artist should be your own critic, and it's got to pass the test.
You kind of make yourself a surrogate for everybody.
Well, I can only do it for myself, but
you got to start somewhere, right?
Yeah, but I wouldn't not want everybody to be anything like me. It'd be like the terrible world. So it's confused, distorted.
Well, you get by, Mel.
Day by day.
Thanks a lot for coming in.
Yeah, appreciate you.
Mel Chin is an artist living in Houston, visiting University of Hawaii as the Dai Ho Chun Distinguished Chair. He'll be giving a talk called "Trouble in Mind" on Wednesday in the Art Auditorium at the Manoa Campus at 6:30 p.m. There are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and our Morning Edition host, Derek Malama, keeps us in touch with them. He joins us at this point in our show every day for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Today, you can enjoy music from 13th century Spain. It's been a while since I've heard music from 13th century
Spain.
Yeah,
me too. Not at all.
That's in Hilo, yeah?
Right. The concert's tomorrow. King Alfonso X ruled during that period, 13th century Spain, and he welcomed leaders of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam to all gather in his court. And the Peabody Consort from Baltimore will perform vocals and instrumentals from that time period. The concert is called A Vanished World, Music of Three Faiths, and it's happening in the UH Hilo Performing Arts Center tomorrow at 7:30.
Hmm. Now, here's an opportunity for members of the Kaka'ako community, rapidly growing, to bring their ideas about making this road safer, yeah?
Oh, yes. The Complete Streets Project looks for ways to accommodate people who travel by foot, bicycle, transit, or cars. And this two-hour session will explore neighborhood-level issues and opportunities, and it's happening at the HCDA, and that's at 545 Queen Street from 5 to 7:30 tomorrow. It's free, and you can RSVP at the link on our website.
And you learn specific skills to use with people who are close to you. That sounds interesting.
Yes.
At a workshop in Kona tomorrow.
Yes. Andrea Pro, she is a pro. She is a certified nonviolent communication coach, and she will present a one-hour program on key skills to improve connection, trust, and cooperation with your family and your friends and colleagues. And she'll also hand out a guide for effective listening, which we could all do. It's at 5:30 p.m. tomorrow in the Kailua Kona Library.
Well, thanks, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Balama joins the conversation to take a nonviolent look at events in our community going on under the radar. And you can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Tab Bowers with American Savings Bank. We've been underwriting HPR for over 20 years. HPR is an organization that's got a lot of reach and breadth. And so any organization that wants to expand the way that they're working across the community would find that HPR is a great partner. And also, I find that the people here have real passion for what they're doing. That makes it very easy to see this as a true partnership.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, the head of the employees' retirement system looks at the unfunded liability. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HII Conversation. Past shows are on The Conversation page. Look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow.